So the theme for tonight's talk is judging the truth, moral intolerance, or the dictatorship of relativism. So, thou shalt not judge. For our contemporary culture, and especially for the typical university culture today, this is often treated like the first and greatest commandment, and perhaps even the only commandment. The great sin of our epoch, I think you could claim, is to be judgmental. And in a way, in postmodernity, it's a kind of capital vice. So this poses a special challenge for the university, and especially, I think, for university students and for university teachers. But let's speak for a moment about students, since that's mostly who's here in the room. I think it's a challenge not only because there is a kind of stigma that can be attached to someone who is judged to be judgmental, and that stigma can be painful and powerful, even socially, but also because students have often come to the university after many years of formation and socialization that being judgmental is a very bad thing to be. And so they really don't want to be or be perceived as judgmental. So the job that I'd like to tackle, or the task that I'd like to tackle in this talk, is really whether being judgmental is a vice or a sin, and if yes, in what sense, and how this is related to contemporary claims about truth, tolerance, and moral relativism. So let's begin with the question of being judgmental. Is it a vice or a sin to be judgmental? And if yes, in what sense? So you sometimes hear it said, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. And if you insist that it's true for me, well, then you're being intolerant of people who make different choices, and you are, in effect, judging them and thus harming them. That's a kind of presupposition or sometimes explicit argument that you would encounter on a typical university campus today, I think. And I think it poses a serious challenge for the university, first on a theoretical level, because in many different disciplines you will encounter sources that are making claims that something is true, and perhaps even with some moral dimension to the claim. And students will then receive that as being bigoted or intolerant or judgmental. So that makes discussing those subjects difficult and problematic. I think it also presents a challenge on a second level, and it may be a more serious challenge for students, in the kind of psychology of being a contemporary student, because the ethic of being non-judgmental is so important to so many. So the task is to find a way to articulate a theory of moral truth that one can accept without feeling like you're being put in a vice where either you have to abandon your principles, maybe even basic principles of reason, or you have to judge and condemn people that most students want to embrace and affirm. So that's the question. How do you navigate through that very difficult obstacle course? Now, if being judgmental is a vice, does it mean that every judgment that we make is an act, a vicious act, a sin? Now, it seems not, if we think about it for a minute, because most people have no problem at all accepting that there are scientific truths, for example, that we would be able to say are valid in all places and at all times. And generally speaking, those who are concerned about being judgmental are not taking a position that of sort of theoretical or universal philosophical skepticism about whether we can know any truth at all. Usually they would concede that you can know some kind of truth about the world around us through scientific observation or maybe mathematical, theoretical mathematics or even just arithmetic, something like that. And This is a very good thing, in fact, that people are able to at least admit that much, or at least accept that much, because if one was that skeptical about what reason could know, about what we can know about the world around us, the whole enterprise of the university would be, well, very difficult, if not futile. Aquinas actually can help us here, because he teaches that there are basically two sorts of acts that our mind makes. And not to get into we could go very deep into the theoretical, philosophical explanation of how our mind works, according to Aquinas. So this is just a very simple summary, but one kind of act is apprehending things around us. We grasp that there are things in the world, and you grasp something about what it is. You encounter Fido and Spot and Rover, and then you apprehend that there are such things as dogs. And you, in doing that, are sort of grasping or abstracting even from these individual animals an idea of dog. And then there is a second sort of act of the mind, which the Thomist tradition calls judgment. Obviously, something that we should wonder, is this being judgmental? What is judgment according to this Thomist theory? It's when you take something like the idea of a dog, and then you make judgments joining and separating some other reality or property with respect to that that thing. So in a sentence, you have a subject and a predicate, and you're putting those together by means of a verb. And that's making a judgment if you're saying that the sentence is true. So something like, this dog is brown, or this dog is angry. You have to understand dog, and you have to understand brown or angry, and you're putting them together, and you're judging that this is really the case right now, that this dog is angry. Or more fundamentally, you can make a claim about reality by saying dogs exist and unicorns do not, or at least as far as I know, they don't. Okay, so this is a very basic form of judging, and I don't think anyone would say you're being judgmental when you make a judgment like that. It's a judgment about reality. Okay, where it gets more difficult is when we start talking about moral judgments. And that's usually what people are talking about when they're concerned about being judgmental. And the problem seems to be that we don't want to make judgments about persons, because somehow making a judgment about persons or their worth is to harm the person by making if we make a negative judgment. Now, on this point, actually, St. Thomas Aquinas also offers us some very helpful distinctions, and I think a real way out of the contemporary conundrum over this being judgmental. So Aquinas actually does have a vice that resembles, in some ways, what we would talk about as being judgmental. Just a word about St. Thomas Aquinas for those of you who may not know much about him. He was a medieval Dominican philosopher and theologian, one of the great philosophers and theologians in the Western tradition. So he's a giant in the history of philosophy and of theology. And he wrote a long book called the Summa Theologiae, or Summa Theologica, and in it he has a whole treatment of vices or sins against justice, and he has one called rash judgment. And I think looking at what rash judgment is for Aquinas can help us. He teaches that as human beings, we can only judge what we can see, like an exterior action that someone engages in. And that action might be wrong. It might be a sin. It might be a crime. But he says, we should not presume to judge what we cannot see. And that is specifically the interior movements of the heart of our neighbor. So this is a quotation from Aquinas. For to God alone is reserved the judgment of hidden things, among which especially are counted the thoughts of the heart. And hence, if anyone would presume to judge of these things, it is a rash judgment, and it may be even a serious sin. So Aquinas says that instead of judging our neighbor's intentions harshly or in a bad light, instead of presuming that what looks like a sin to us when we see it from the outside is definitely a sin, he says we should always presume the best about our neighbor. Even when it looks like he's doing something bad, we should presume, by default, that it can be excused. Now, he thinks that sometimes there's very clear evidence that you can judge that, say, this is a crime. We do that in the criminal law, too, when we make a judgment about, like, whether a murderer intended to kill his victim or whether it was just an accident or an act of negligence. We can't get inside his head, but we can look at things that he did outside and judge. That looks like he was intending to do it. He was planning it. He took his time. And then, of course, that makes the act more serious, more seriously wrong. But Aquinas says we should always presume the best about our neighbor. We should love our neighbor. We should desire the good of our neighbors and ultimately their salvation. And in fact, Aquinas goes even further when he talks about judging persons. He says that when you judge a person, there is always the danger that you will damage the person. Because when you make a rash judgment, you are going to dishonor the person, at least in your mind, and maybe by your words and your actions. So here's another quotation from Aquinas. It must be said that it is one thing to judge about things and another to judge about persons. For in making a judgment about things, we can do neither good nor evil to the thing about which we judge. But when we make a judgment about persons, we can indeed do good or evil to the person we judge. Because we will honor a person we judge to be good, and we'll consider a person we judge to be evil worthy of contempt. For this reason, we ought to aim at judging a person to be good, unless there is evident proof to the contrary. Now, listen, he goes on, and this is actually an interesting further point that he makes. He says, it may happen that one who interprets doubtful matters for the best is frequently deceived. So you might actually be making a mistake when you judge that your neighbor had a good intention, because your neighbor might not have had a good intention. He says, but it is better to err frequently by having a good opinion of a bad person than to err occasionally by having a bad opinion of a good person. Because in the latter case, an injury is inflicted, but not in the former. He thinks that if you have a bad opinion of someone, you are, in fact, doing an injury to them. So, from these texts, we can draw two important Thomistic distinctions about making judgments. And I think it's very helpful, especially when you're talking to somebody who gets very nervous about the idea of making a judgment about a person. Okay, what are the distinctions? First, when we speak the truth about an action, a sinful action maybe, or even if you just say when we speak the truth about something that is a sin, we're primarily speaking about and judging actions, which we can observe and assess, and not persons. So to judge a person implies making a judgment about the interior movement of the heart, and that is principally God's domain, not ours. At least insofar as we're private persons. If you're a judge, maybe then, or a juror in a criminal case, maybe you will have to make a judgment based on the law. But in general, it's not for us to make those kinds of judgments about the interior state of our neighbor's heart. And if we presume to do an act like that without sufficient reason, we're committing the sin of rash judgment. Now, the second distinction is closely related to the first. It's between, on the one hand, the objective goodness or evil of an action, we could say its objective rightness or wrongness, and on the other hand, the culpability of the person who does it, the actor. Okay, so we always have to maintain, Aquinas certainly would insist, that an action is going to be objectively right or wrong, and we could say it's a sin or it's a good act, and that it produces something that is good or evil. But there may be some cases where someone does something that it looks like a sin, but without moral fault on the part of the actor, little or none. Okay, so there's an amusing story about this. How many of you know the novelist Douglas Adams? He wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Humorous English writer. Okay, so here's an anecdote that he wrote that illustrates this point. He was taking a train, and he was wrong about what time his train was leaving, so he got to the train station very early and then had some time to kill. So he bought a newspaper, a cup of coffee, and a packet of cookies and sat down at a table. So here's a quotation from him. He says, "I want you to picture the scene. Here's the table, the newspaper, the cup of coffee, the packet of cookies. And there's a guy sitting opposite me, perfectly ordinary looking guy wearing a business suit. It didn't look like he was going to do anything weird. But what he did is this. He suddenly leaned across, picked up the packet of cookies, tore it open, took one out, and ate it. I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do. I ignored it. And I stared at the newspaper, took a sip of coffee, and thought, what am I going to do? In the end, I thought, nothing for it, I'll just have to go for it. And I tried very hard not to notice the fact that the packet was already mysteriously opened. I took out a cookie for myself. I thought, that settled it. But it hadn't, because a moment or two later, he did it again. He took another cookie. We went through the whole packet like this. He took one, I took one, he took one, I took one. Finally, when we got to the end, he stood up and walked away. Well, we exchanged meaningful looks, and then he walked away, and I breathed a sigh of relief and sat back. A moment or two later, my train was coming in, so I tossed back the rest of my coffee, stood up, picked up the newspaper, and underneath the newspaper were my cookies. So, a moral analysis of this case. Objectively, Adams stole the cookies. He stole another man's cookies. That can be a grave offense, by the way. In a Dominican priory, that would be a grave offense. And I bet that the other man thought that what Adams was doing was totally outrageous. Like a brazen, open, intentional act of theft. But Adams was not, in fact, guilty of theft because he did not realize that he was taking another man's cookies. Now, in justice, Adams still owes this man half of a packet of cookies. In other words, the objective evil of his action is not erased by the fact that he was mistaken. It still was an evil done to this man that half of his cookies disappeared. But we would not necessarily say that Adams deserves to be punished for his action, even though it was objectively wrong to do it. So in general, when someone is ignorant through no fault of his own of the wrong he is committing, his action, while objectively wrong in itself, may not involve moral culpability on the part of the actor. The criminal law recognizes this, and it's a helpful distinction to keep in mind. And that's really what Aquinas has in mind when he says you should always presume the best of your neighbor, and not, you can say that is a bad act, but be careful about then concluding that is a bad person engaging in that act, because you don't know why the person was doing that. Now, a further note to add here. The Catholic moral tradition would distinguish further between ignorance about a fact, so I didn't know that the cookies weren't mine, and ignorance about the law itself, like I didn't know it was wrong to take someone else's cookies. I knew they weren't my cookies, but I didn't know it was wrong to take them, because I thought stealing was not wrong, for example. Now, in general, in the Catholic moral tradition, the Catholic moral tradition would hold that the basic precepts of the moral law, like the Ten Commandments, are so universally known by human beings that no one can really plead ignorance with respect to them. So you think of the Ten Commandments, basically. Everyone is held to observe them. Okay. Now, we've drawn this distinction that Aquinas uses, or these distinctions, which are helpful, I think, for understanding making judgments. But let's now go a little further into talking about the challenge that the claim that there are no objective right and wrong moral truths out there, or that actions, even actions, are not morally wrong, or cannot be. So this requires us to speak a little bit about relativism. Now, relativism comes in several different varieties. So this is kind of part two of the talk here. Relativism comes in several different varieties, many of which can be found on contemporary university campuses. For example, you might think of cultural relativism, or historical relativism, or linguistic relativism, or, if we were in a law school, legal positivism, which in an extreme form can be a kind of relativism. So what do these relativisms teach? How do they formulate their position? According to a standard form of cultural relativism, right and wrong depends on what the dominant culture says, or on what you were conditioned to believe by social, religious, and cultural forces, maybe when you were being brought up or something like that. It contends that there is no standard of right and wrong that transcends your culture. So all judgments about right and wrong, according to this view, are embedded within a cultural system, and different cultural systems may have different forms of making those judgments, and you can't really cross over from one to another to assess one over against another. What about historical relativism? It would argue that what is right and wrong depends on the mores, the customs or morals, of a certain historical period. So what people thought was right in the 18th century, we now see is wrong, or vice versa. So a very common argument on a point like this would be, listen, 150 years ago, just over that, slavery was legal in the United States and was even praised by some as a positive good. Well, today, you can hardly find anyone, or very few people, thankfully, who would deny that slavery is gravely morally wrong. So this is presented as evidence that there are no claims to moral rightness or wrongness that transcend a given historical period. Moral truth, on this view, would merely be the product of a historical period, so a cultural period or a cultural environment or a historical period. Legal positivism says something like that. We don't need to go into all of that, but it basically says what is right or wrong depends on what the law says. So if the law says that abortion is illegal and wrong, then abortion is wrong. If the law says that it's right, then it's permitted and therefore morally legitimate. And there is no standard of right and wrong beyond what the positive law tells us. Okay, that would be a strong form of legal positivism. Now, all of these forms of relativism have in common the claim that there is no unchanging, non-arbitrary standard of right and wrong. They have in common the claim that all moral claims are relative in some sense to culture, historical context, to language, to legal regime, and so forth. So what kind of answer would a Thomist make to these claims of relativism? There are a few things that we can say. The first and perhaps most important is to say that, to note that the fatal flaw of all these forms of relativism is that they contain an internal contradiction. They assert that the proposition, there are no truths that hold always and everywhere, so that's a kind of implicit claim being made by someone advancing a relativist argument, there are no truths, no moral truths that are always and everywhere valid. Someone is claiming that nonetheless this is a truth that holds always and everywhere. So that's a kind of internal contradiction just in making the statement. We could go on. While there might be some superficial evidence that seems to support cultural and historical relativism, like disagreements across cultures about right and wrong, or between different historical periods, like slavery, for example, we could say, well, the relativist argument nonetheless ignores much broader and deeper agreements about moral principles. And what is more, why should the fact that some people, and even some cultures, have made excuses for gravely wrong actions, for things that are gravely morally wrong, why should that lead us to conclude that there are no such gravely wrong things? In other words, just because someone in 1858 argued that slavery was okay, does not mean even then that slavery was okay. Nor should we conflate the moral status of social or cultural conventions like rules of etiquette. Belching at the table, for example, is very rude if you do it in Berkeley, probably. Well, I don't know. If you do it at your parents' dinner table, they would probably tell you it's very rude. But in some cultures, it's even a necessity of showing that you have enjoyed a good meal. So obviously, what is wrong in one place is right in another, but we're not necessarily speaking about some serious moral question there. This is a question of etiquette. So don't conflate conventions with deeper moral principles, like the direct killing of an innocent human person is wrong. That's a different kind of claim. And in fact, the relativist argument deliberately obscures these distinctions, claiming that because some moral censures are merely based on convention, therefore there are no enduring moral principles. But that doesn't follow. Notice also that the relativist must claim not only that one is sometimes determined by your historical period or culture, but that you are always determined, so that all moral claims are historically or culturally conditioned. So it's no problem to say, yes, some claims that you'll find in any culture will be conditioned by the dominant culture or by the historical period. It's much more difficult to argue that all moral claims are historically conditioned. In fact, it seems plainly to be false. Do we not see people challenging the moral wrongs in their own historical epoch and in their own culture all the time? Indeed, they often do so by appealing to universal moral principles. That is, not merely by claiming that we should apply a different rule from some other time or culture. They don't say, oh, well, another culture would judge us to be wrong. They simply assert, this is unjust, or this is wrong. And that wouldn't be possible if we were always conditioned by our culture or by our historical period. In other words, it seems possible to stand outside of your historical period and your culture and make a judgment about it. And that's the very thing that the relativist position must deny is even possible. So if that's possible, then it suggests that you are not simply totally formed in your moral judgments merely by history or culture. So this is unsurprising to a Thomist, this conclusion, because according to St. Thomas, moral judgments are in fact judgments about what is good. And there is an unbreakable metaphysical link between being and goodness. So we're getting now to the kind of the deepest part of this talk. We're talking about being. Insofar as something exists, Aquinas would say, it is good. It is good to be. So for Aquinas, the very structure of our desiring and of our acting necessarily implies that we try to obtain, that we desire what we judge will be good for me. And that ultimately, those desires, those thirsts that we have, are anchored in the sort of beings that we are. even though from time to time, to be sure, we can make mistakes in judging what will really be good for me. And in fact, sometimes we have very disordered desires. We could talk about original sin and its effects in us, the way we now have desires that don't actually lead us towards what is really good for me. But in fact, this is the fundamental orientation of every person, is to reach out for what that person perceives to be good. At this point, a common objection often pops up, and maybe some of you are thinking of it right now. Well, wait a second, Father, that doesn't seem to be right, because there certainly seem to be some people who do aim at doing evil things. Aren't they seeking then an evil? Think of like the cold-blooded serial murderer. Isn't the serial murderer seeking an evil, not a good? Well, from Aquinas' perspective, actually, the account of that is a little more complicated than you might think. Even that case of the cold-blooded serial murderer follows the general rule that one only desires and wills something insofar as you perceive it as a good in some respect. So even a murderer does not aim at evil precisely as bad for me, but as in some respect, wrongly, perversely even, because he finds some good or pleasure in the act or in its effects. I mean, that's obviously very dark if that happens to someone. But that does seem to be what the murderer is seeking, not just an evil for its own sake. So we should add to this that pursuing the wrong goods, and we're always pursuing goods, but if we're pursuing goods that don't fit, that are out of order somehow, that are therefore disordered, or pursuing things that are good in the wrong way, we can produce real evil. This is another element of the Thomistic teaching on good and evil. Here, a very good example is Michael Corleone from the Godfather films. Probably most of you have seen The Godfather, the first film. I don't want to spoil the result for anybody who's not seen the film. Even the first two Godfather films. By the way, somebody told me, don't watch Godfather 3. I watched it on an airplane. I regretted watching it. Don't watch Godfather 3. This is my advice for you. So the first two Godfather films. Michael Corleone starts off as a good guy. And what you watch over the course of these films is the descent of a good man into evil. At each decisive moment as that first film goes on, Michael chooses to do something that he regards to be a good under these particular circumstances, to defend his father, to protect his family, to avenge an evil, to make money, that's good in general, to win the esteem and respect of others. And we, the audience, we see that there's something good in what he's pursuing, and we tend to root for him, even, in the movie. But he's using the wrong means to these ends. And because he's seeking some things that are partially good, but in the wrong way, or things that are disrupting other goods, for example, what is due to his neighbor, or what the common good of society requires, or what natural law and God's commands tell him to do, because he's disregarding those things, his actions are wrong, and they lead him into a deeper web of evil. So the drama is that we watch a good man become, by his own choices, a man perverted by evil, so that in the end, he destroys his family, which is the very thing he started out to protect. So for Aquinas, this is a very good illustration of a metaphysical claim about evil. Evil is not a positive thing. It is the absence of what should be there. It's disorder where there should be order. So it is not possible to desire evil as such, because evil is not, strictly speaking. You can only desire something but something that maybe is not fitting or has a privation associated with it. So this brings us, I think, to the most important claim I want to make about moral relativism. All persons will always orient themselves to something they think is good. And we find that in actual practice, they will inevitably make claims on others, even demands on others, about what they think is good. So notwithstanding all of our professions of being non-judgmental, or even to be explicitly relativist, if you find somebody like that, we will in fact find all kinds of judgments being made about what is good. And judgments not only about scientific or factual matters, pragmatic matters, but even moral questions. So think of the law, for example, our own laws in the United States. It's the essence of any law to make a judgment. It's very hard to come up with an example of a law that doesn't make a judgment. The criminal law, for example, says that it is wrong, it's illegal to kill another person. And if you do, you will be punished, and quite severely. Okay, you are judged, quite literally judged, and condemned by the judge to a prison sentence or to some penalty. Why does the law do this? Is it only to protect you, or to protect other people from being murdered by the guy a second time? Not simply. Rather, it's to do that and to justly punish a wrong that has been done. This is why the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., at least until a few years ago, I don't know if it still exists, I think it still does, had an office to pursue Nazi war criminals who at this point are in their 90s. So there's a team of lawyers and investigators trying to track these men down. Why are we doing that? We are not really going to be able to put them in prison. When you have an elderly man who murders his elderly wife, and the fact comes out and he's arrested, say he's 92, he's not going to do it again. He's not even able to. But we will still bring a prosecution against a person like that, even if we decide we're going to mitigate the sentence, we're not going to put you in jail. Why? Because it is important to judge that crime as wrong, to pass judgment that this action was wrong. And in fact, even environmental regulations do this. So we might be tempted to think that regulations about recycling, for example, or about keeping the air quality clean, are purely factual or scientific, that they're justified by purely factual or scientific statements, like high carbon emissions decrease air quality. Sounds like a very neutral factual judgment. But in fact, it bears within it the conclusion that we should not emit carbon. And don't we all make moral judgments about polluters? I can tell you my own personal experience about this. Back in the early 90s, I went to college. I went to Claremont McKenna College in the LA area. And of course, we recycled. You know, I got there, we had a recycling bin. And then I went back to the East Coast for law school. And when I arrived at law school, the city where my law school was didn't even recycle. You could not recycle if you wanted to. So here I was in my dorm room piling up a stockpile of aluminum cans because I couldn't bring myself to throw them in the trash. Now, can you identify with that? I felt guilty throwing those cans in the trash. I was doing something wrong. It's not good stewardship of the environment to do that. That is a moral judgment. And it's normal and natural for us to draw those conclusions, even based on what seem to be kind of neutral factual assessments. Because when we make a judgment, even about a scientific fact, there will be an assessment in some respect about what is good for the environment, what is good for our political community, what is good for our campus. So this is the capital point that I want to underscore. For Aquinas, this is going back to the beginning of the talk, where we started, there is not a radical difference between the kind of judgment that something exists, that Fido is brown, or that Fido is a German shepherd. There's not a radical disjunction between that kind of judgment and what we would characterize as moral judgments. So Goldie the goldfish exists. She is alive. She is gold. Okay? Those are factual judgments. And then we can very quickly conclude, given that Goldie is a goldfish, it is bad to take her out of her tank. It will hurt Goldie. Goldie will not last very long out of the tank. And it's really bad to flush her down the toilet. Don't do that to Goldie. These are judgments about reality, that it will be bad for Goldie. Our minds are grasping something true about the world around us, and we are then seeing what is good about that reality. So it is normal, in fact, inevitable, that we will judge some things to be good and others to be bad and avoided and to be avoided. That is part of the structure of the human mind. And it doesn't require us to judge the interior of the hearts of our neighbors. That is, to make a judgment about whether this is a good or bad person, or a person worthy of love and acceptance, or a person that I could even seek to do good to. We should seek to do good to lots of people. And in fact, this is something that all of us can try to begin to put into practice in our lives. So to conclude this section about moral relativism, in fact, there really aren't any practical relativists. You might have a theoretical moral relativist, but it's very, very hard to be a practical relativist because we make moral judgments all the time. The real question is, will we camouflage them or bring them out into the open where they can be assessed and debated? And so this is my final point. So we're just about done here. The plane is on its final approach to the runway. I wanted to say something about the consequences for our life together of moral relativism. This is something that perhaps we don't think about and reflect on enough or talk about, because often civility or tolerance or being non-judgmental is presented as what will enable us to have a civil relationship of, like on a university campus or in our country, something like that. But from the Catholic perspective, and John Paul II has some very beautiful reflections on this, moral relativism actually is disastrous for our common life together, for politics, for example. In the classical sense of the word, politics concerns the common good of the community, of the political community, the polis. So the classical exercise of politics is the search for and deliberation about the common good. Citizens come together and reason together about what is good for our community. And of course, there will often be disagreements about what we judge will be good for our community. And that's normal and natural, and that's what politics is all about. We argue about what we think will be good for our community. But in a healthy political system, what you have is a reasoned deliberation. You have arguments based on reason. You are making arguments. And that presupposes that there are really things that are good for our political community, or good for the human person, good for our university, that we can talk about. Other people can perceive them too. We can persuade someone that that you thought was not that important is actually really important, and we need to put that at the top of the list of priorities. So politics is about that search for the common good, or it should be anyway. The difficulty is that if we accept the discourse of relativism, and allow it to become the normative language of our political discourse, which I think in large part we have, in fact, done, then the unavoidable judgments, the judgments that everyone is always making about what they think is good, they become camouflaged. We can no longer bring them out into the open as easily. We cannot argue as easily about what those goods are. And politics then becomes an exercise of will and of power, not of public reason. So what you have instead of a deliberation about what is good for our community, you have one group trying to simply assert its will over another, no longer making arguments. So listen to what John Paul II wrote about exactly this this aspect of relativism. He wrote this in his encyclical Veritatis Splendor, and you can hear in it some of his experiences as a young Pole, having grown up under two totalitarian regimes, first the Nazis and then the Polish communists in the Eastern Bloc, that taught him that relativism comes with an enormous, a monstrous human cost. So this is John Paul II. Totalitarianism arises out of a denial of truth in the objective sense. If there is no transcendent truth, in obedience to which man achieves his full identity, then there is no sure principle for guaranteeing just relations among people. Their self-interest as a class, a group, or a nation would inevitably set them in opposition to one another. If one does not acknowledge transcendent truth, then the force of power takes over, and each person tends to make full use of the means at his disposal in order to impose his own interests or his own opinion with no regard for the rights of others. I think John Paul's insight that a crisis of truth leads to a crisis of democracy, you might say, of a crisis in political culture, and ultimately to a crisis of freedom, because in the absence of some objective truth, you cannot appeal to anything like an argument or to reason, but only in the end to power. And this is what Pope Benedict XVI later called a dictatorship of relativism. So in his argument, relativism will force you into this kind of non-reasoned dynamic. So without rational discourse, there can be only assertions of an ideology or of a will to power. And bringing this back to the university, this is the very opposite of the purpose of the university, which is to engender the life of reason in coming to know the reality around us. So, judgmental, Aquinas would say, you can judge actions, but not persons, and you must, in some way, you always will, make judgments about what is good and what is evil. And this is simply to know the reality around you. This is the path to a respectful and reasoned dialogue about what is really good, and pursuing that good individually and together. That is our task together. So thank you very much for your attention, and be happy to take any objections, questions, qualifications, arguments counter.
Father, in light of what you're saying about judging actions and not persons, can you say more about the best way then to sort of preach morality based on these principles? What comes up for you there? How do you see that going?
Well, it's important for the church, for example, or me as a priest, to speak about what is objectively true, and also to guide people towards their true good. So I mean, we could simplify this very much and just say, love the sinner and hate the sin. So a judgment about this action, which is a sin, or maybe even this whole pattern of actions that you're engaged in, you're in the mafia, it's not good, get out of it, it's going to do damage to a lot of other people and to you too. So trying to find a way to help you while affirming that God loves you and I care about you and this is actually going to be good for you. In fact, this is the way to happiness for you in the long run. So from the perspective of Aquinas, that is what morality is all about. This is a common misconception, especially even among Catholics, that morality is about, especially in the larger culture, but even among Catholics, that morality is about commandments, like telling you what not to do, or telling you what is wrong, what is forbidden. But in the classical way of thinking about it, certainly for Aquinas, that is not the case. Morality is not about, principally, commandments and prohibitions and punishments. Morality is about how to get to real happiness. And ultimately, the only real happiness will be life with God. So then morality becomes, how do you live in order to have life with God? And the commandments are kind of negative ways by which God teaches us what paths are going to lead us off the cliff and to be very unhappy. In the same way that a mother with her little child will say, don't touch the hot stove. So that's out of a love for the child that prohibition is given. Not because the child just needs to obey, but because touching the hot stove is going to damage the child. And that's, in fact, spiritually true about every sin. It's going to damage the sinner and maybe lots of other people too. Yes?
Kind of adding on to that, how do you mentally go from, okay, it's okay to judge actions as being sinful, but not, to say that person is a sinner or, that person is evil. But then also, doing like, say, St. Paul, kind of encouraged us to do, which is if you know someone, church who's sinning, to go and talk to them privately, and if they don't want to, hear what you have to say, bring someone else to corroborate that what they're doing is not wrong, and then if they don't want to hear from you, then deep into the church, and then, have them, face reality, and if they still don't want to change their ways, then to, basically treat them like a Gentile or a, whatever it was. I forgot what it was, but, how do you make that mental leap from saying, okay, I can't, what they're doing is wrong, and, I'm not going to call them a sinner, but I'm going to take it upon myself because I love that person, I don't want them to sin anymore and offend God, to, go ahead and say it's okay. I can go over there and say, hey, you sinner, stop it.
Well, so that's an excellent question, and so as private individuals, I think we could say, okay, I should, in fact, Aquinas would say, I have a duty to try and help my neighbor, and that includes correcting my neighbor. So there's a duty of fraternal correction to say to my neighbor, hey, that what you're doing is wrong, and it's hurting yourself, it's hurting other people, it's not leading you in the right direction. Okay, so that is to be done out of love for the person, and out of a desire to see the person flourish and grow in virtue, grow in relationship with God, move towards ultimate happiness. When you judge that a fraternal correction like that, that's what Aquinas calls the technical word, a fraternal correction. When you judge that a fraternal correction would not have the desired effect, like would just make the person angry at you, they can't receive it, and it's just going to cause a blow-up or something like that, then he says you don't have an obligation to engage in that fraternal correction. But then when you consider, okay, what if you're a person responsible for the common good of a local parish? Or to make it even simpler, you're living in a group house, or maybe you're living in a dormitory, and you've got an RA who's...
You're the head of a
Or you're the head of a family, right? So any of those examples. But just to stick with the university example, you're the RA on a floor. Do you just ignore that this person is making all kinds of noise and keeping everybody up at 4 in the morning? I mean, 2 in the morning, that's reasonable. But 4 in the morning is totally out, you know. So at what point do you, you actually have a kind of public responsibility for the common good, which obliges you now in a more serious way to try and stop the disruption, even if the person is like going to be upset and it's and blow up and whatever. The good of everyone on the floor calls for that kind of correction. And the criminal law actually is aiming at the same kind of thing. It's a, the good of the political community requires actually that there be some system for correcting people and stopping them from doing, actions that are damaging to the common good. It doesn't necessarily follow, however, that you would correct every wrong. The RA is probably not going to be investigating like whether you're spending too much time watching YouTube videos and not doing your homework. Like that's not the RA's responsibility to be worrying about that. It may be bad for you to watch too many YouTube videos. But that's not the RA's. The RA is concerned with what damages the common good of the floor. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I may not be going all the way to the end of your question, but yes, I mean, we do have a duty to correct each other. And at some point, the good of the community may require that somebody is even excluded from the community, like what you're talking about with if there's a grave scandal in the Christian community. That's what St. Paul is talking about. So for the good of the Christian community, there may need to be some, what in contemporary canon law terms we would call a medicinal punishment. The idea is that the punishment is not trying to hurt the person, but is trying to say through the punishment, listen, this is serious. You're damaging yourself. You're damaging the community. We can't let you keep doing it. Yeah.
This may be like a little too broad, but can you think of some kind of major like turning points in history or like history of ideas in which kind of, because there's kind of this narrative of like, you know, modern relativism. What are some of the like key turning points that have helped bring that about?
Well, probably the history, I mean, I don't know that I'd hold myself out as qualified to trace the history of that idea. Certainly, if you look at some of the key changes, for Aquinas in the 13th century, you have a very clear sense of the connection between being and goodness. So if something is, it is good, and to see how that operates. When later thinkers begin to separate that and claim that, well, goodness is really a separate kind of judgment. It's a judgment about a kind of moral quality, and it comes really from the fact that, say, God has decreed by his will that this action is wrong, and therefore if you disobey God's will, you're doing something wrong. That's one way of thinking about morals went historically after the 13th century. You could say that is the kind of taking a step down the road that will lead you, not perhaps strictly speaking to relativism, but certainly to the problems where you feel like, right and wrong is just a kind of arbitrary judgment. It's an arbitrary judgment of God. He might have said that murdering your neighbor was good, and then it would have been good, but he just happened to say that it was bad, and so it's bad. And then you cease seeing the reason why what the commandments prohibit, why they're evil. Does that make sense?
So we're talking about things seem to be objectively good or evil, but also there are degrees of that, perhaps. And say, for example, like you're like leader of a country, and you think that slavery is objectively evil, but you also know that in order to outlaw that, you'd have to kill, say, a lot of men who benefit from that system. So, like, when it comes to, you know, elevating certain evils or saying something, one thing's more evil than another, what action should I choose? How would Aquinas?
Yeah, well, I mean, this was the drama that we had in the United States around this, in the lead up to the Civil War. And Abraham Lincoln, you know, said, well, my job is not to abolish slavery, actually. It's just to preserve the Union. And that was the legal title under which he prosecuted the Civil War. But yes, it would have been, I mean, just to say this is evil and therefore we're going to eradicate the evil by force, and it's going to, you would have to make a judgment about whether that is a proportionate way to try and remedy the wrong. So you might think of just war theory. I don't know if you know much about just war theory, but that is part of the calculus in judging like whether a war is just. You have a just cause, so what the aggressor is doing is evil in some sense, but can you just indiscriminately wage war against the aggressor? The Catholic tradition says no, it has to be a grave evil. You have to have a good chance of success. It has to be proportionate. You know, the damage that you'll do has to be proportionate and so forth. So there's a lot of other prudential judgments that would come into the practical decision about whether, you know, how to deal with this. Another thing that I might mention is that Aquinas thinks that, for example, the law, the civil law, should not outlaw all things that are wrong. So the civil law's job is to safeguard the common good. Now, the common good is going to be better, we're all going to be better off if everyone is very virtuous, but the law cannot just oblige everyone to be virtuous. It's hard to be virtuous. So the law tries to prohibit the worst vices. And there may be some prudential judgments, even across different legal regimes and different historical periods and cultures, about how to make that calculus. You know, so in medieval Europe, it was not uncommon that some prostitution was legally permitted. We in the United States, most states prohibit prostitution. Some states permit it. Okay, so it's not a judgment that prostitution is okay. The medieval mind did not think prostitution was okay. But it thought that it might be more difficult to outlaw it than not. So, you know, you can have that kind of debate. Yes?
So it seems like the whole argument is that consequentially, this way of judging actions over persons will on net yield an improvement in the quality of judgments, so that they will lead to an increase of righteous actions within the society. But is there actually an explicit version of such an argument that this process indeed yields a better outcome over time as opposed to the alternatives?
So I think that would, what you're suggesting is that maybe we could have a kind of utilitarian argument, if I'm understanding you correctly. So to say, well, we will have the best outcomes if we don't judge individuals, but only actions. And therefore, we will just, because we'll hurt people's feelings or people will feel excluded or we will damage the common good in some way. Is that?
I mean, it seems like at the heart there of discussion, there seems to be an imperative to increase the amount of good in the world.
Yeah.
Therefore, since there is such an imperative, the whole strategy assumes that it will yield such an increase. And I was just, one could then say that, well, okay, what if by using the power and a conquest of wills in politics, one in fact increases the amount of good more than one would by treating other persons as inherently good and only judging their actions. I don't necessarily agree with this myself, but how would one...
I see. Well, so I think to go back to the kind of the deepest level, Aquinas thinks that just on an individual level, when I as a private citizen make a judgment about your intentions, especially if I'm, you know, I'm judging you, oh, you know, she is got all kinds of problems. I can see it already. I can see it coming. You know, that is, insofar as it's not based on knowing you from the inside, that there is an injustice in doing that. And so that is evil, actually, for me to do. Now, it's not evil for me to judge the action that you did, which I can see from the outside. When you move on to the, you know, to a higher sphere, where, you know, someone has care of the common good, it's important to control the external actions of people, and that may require drawing an inference about whether you intended to do this or you didn't intend to do it, and we punish you in a different way if you intended to do it. So that's not necessarily wrong for the society to do on some level, or for the person in authority to do. But with circumspection, recognizing that I can't actually see into your heart and know what you're doing. So I don't think the argument is really about a kind of utilitarian argument about how can we cause more good, and this is just a better strategy for doing it, but it's actually an evaluation of the activity of judging itself. Yes?
A sort of diagnostic question. So you mentioned earlier sort of camouflaging that you and J.P. II would observe as one of the greatest problems with the relativistic position, insofar as once we do this, we're even unable to discuss the truth or something to that extent. So it seems to me that this happens quite often within the university here at Berkeley, specifically insofar as it seems, even being charitable, that many are unaware of their own commitments. So if you take social justice to be one of the maximal, the maximal intentions of a student on campus, which it often is, it's often the case that one isn't noticing that this absolute mission might come into conflict with a more classical mission of the university, namely free speech or something, or the pursuit of truth. So I guess my question to you is, with that in the background, do you think, you know, you went to Yale and Claremont's a little bit different, but do you see a problem with this camouflaging occurring at the university, maybe at a level where we're already or becoming rapidly unable to even discuss the university's mission outside of these boundaries?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a challenge for the university. And when it's very helpful to get out into the open, you know, that we're disagreeing about what we think is good here. And to say, well, certain claims about, you know, you have this claim that's good and I have a different claim, you know, something else is a higher good or something like that. To be able to speak clearly about what is good for the human being, what is good for our university community, that I think has a way of allowing us to have a reasoned discussion about it, rather than cutting off a reasoned discussion or kind of saying there are certain viewpoints that we cannot allow into the discussion.
Quick follow-up. Just so on a more practical note, do you, just your personal opinion, do you think that the phenomenon that you've been describing is overblown at all across the board, or do you see a significant problem at top colleges across the
board? Well, I mean, I guess I would say I think. I mean, first of all, we're going to disagree about, it's natural and normal for human beings to disagree about some of these things. So we shouldn't be scandalized by the fact that we have disagreements.
Right.
And the question is, how do we channel the disagreements and make it something that can be constructive rather than, and you know, maybe in the end we're going to say, well, we just have irreconcilable disagreements about this and we're just not going to come to some agreement. Which in fact may be the case, but Yes, I think it's a, I think it's something that is a relatively, you know, you do see it on many university campuses, I think. Yes.
Yeah, thanks, Father. I just had a question about, you gave the Thomist eight-point response to the claim of moral relativism. And the first one that you gave was that it includes the eternal competition. And I was just wondering if you could clarify that for me, because I think what you said is that there's a proposition that there's no moral truths that hold always and everywhere valid, but that claim itself is one such. But I think, but it seems like you could say that there's no truths that hold ever, always and everywhere, and that claim is one such, which would be an argument against relativism in general. But to say that there's no moral truths that hold always and everywhere, that's not really a moral claim.
Well, I guess that would require us to have a further conversation about what counts as a moral truth, and whether it really ultimately makes sense to draw a strong distinction between, you know, a claim what you say is a moral truth versus a just a truth in general. I think for Aquinas, in the end, if you're making a judgment about being, there will follow some judgment about goodness, which is what we're talking about.
Yeah, that probably connects to your point about how our modern mind often splits the goodness from the being, and the fact from the value. So it might be a harder argument to make to kind of a contemporary-minded audience.
Yes,
So, to respect everyone's time, and because we only have the room till 8:30, I need to cut it off now. But thank you so much, Father Dominic.
Thank you, and thank you all.